Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change and equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association, we're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm Megan Etsy, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, change makers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. It's time to get our voices, our future. Today, we are welcoming Dr. Jessica Lowe. She's a staff physician at Bay Health Medical Center, where she serves as both a neurologist and an epileptologist. She earned her undergraduate degree from the University of Vermont with a concentration in neurobiology, graduating magna cum laude. She also went on then to receive her medical degree from Ross University, where she graduated with highest honors. Dr. Lowe completed her postgraduate training in both neurology and epilepsy at Spectrum Health in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Following her training, Dr. Lowe relocated to Delaware to provide in an underserved community. At Bay Health, she currently serves as a neurohospitalist and lead epileptologist within the Department of Neurology. In addition to her clinical work, Dr. Lowe is actively involved in advocacy and leadership. She serves on the Board of Epilepsy Foundation of Delaware and on the Executive Leadership Committee of the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women campaign. She was recognized as one of Delaware's top doctors in 2024 and was named the American Heart Association of Delaware's 2025 Woman of Impact. Thank you for being here, Dr. Lowe.
Thanks for having me.
So to start us off, can you just tell us a bit about your journey into medicine and what inspired you to pursue this path, especially as a woman navigating a historically male-dominated field?
Yeah, sure. So my journey into medicine started in the Bahamas, where I was born and raised. Growing up, I saw how limited access to specialized healthcare was, especially in neurology, and how often people there had to travel to the United States just to get the kind of care that they needed. And that really made a strong impression on me at a young age. And I realized how life-changing proper medical care could be. And I knew I wanted to be a part of providing that kind of care to others. So although I haven't been able to return home to practice, I've really focused my work on serving the underserved populations here in the United States, particularly in communities where specialty care is out of reach. And, you know, that commitment is just very personal to me, and it's rooted in where I come from and the gaps in healthcare that I saw growing up. Now, with regard to a woman navigating a field that is historically male dominated, you know, I've definitely encountered bias along the way, you know, from subtle doubts in my authority or just overt double standards on how things and confidence is perceived, and just not always seeing people who look like me in leadership. But rather than being discouraged by that, you know, those challenges have really fueled my resolve to, you know, succeed and to advocate for equity, both for my patients and for women in medicine. And I've been incredibly fortunate to have strong female and male mentors who have showed me what's possible and encouraged me to keep going, even when things got really rough. So, you know, now as I continue my journey in medicine, it's just kind of like a personal calling, but also a platform to help create this more inclusive and supportive environment, especially for women and underrepresented voices. And that commitment is actually what inspired me to create, you know, my Dr. Brain Barbie social media, because, you know, that's where I get to advocate for women in medicine and educate patients and use humor and transparency to just, you know, challenge stereotypes that exist in the field. And then for patients, you know, make the science and the system seem more approachable, you know? So, it's been a lot of fun. And this is also why I'm so passionate about conversations like this, because this is, you know, us doing the work to shift the culture of medicine.
Absolutely. I know I've seen a lot on like TikTok lately that People are saying you need to meet your patients where they're at. Well, they're all on TikTok now, so they're
Exactly.
there. We need to be there.
It's the future. And medicine, change in medicine is slow. But patients aren't getting their information from television commercials anymore. They're not getting their information from even Google searches anymore. They come into their appointments or they're in the hospital and they say, "Well, I saw a video on TikTok about MS and or about," and I'm like, "All right, well, if you're going to be getting your medical info from TikTok, then we're going to be putting real medical info out there." And so, I'm happy to see that the medical community, certain members, and very strong members are embracing that and using that platform to educate patients and also just kind of show the more human side of medicine, right? I know when
Yeah.
you go and you see a physician and they're a neurologist and a subspecialized in epilepsy, and you walk in there and they have all these degrees on the wall, it can be intimidating. And it's like, listen, we're human too. We'll meet you where you're at. We're funny. We are approachable. And I think TikTok kind of gives that opportunity to show the more human side of your physician. And just kind of make patients more comfortable while also having to maintain that physician-patient relationship. So that's a bit of a line that we have to learn to walk. But overall, I will say my patients have loved it. Like they just, and I will tell you, who I am on TikTok is exactly who I am at bedside. So there's no
I love
there's no
it.
surprise. They're not like, "Oh, she was completely different." Nope, that's who I am through and through. But yeah, patients have really, really, it has resonated with them and it has made them really comfortable. And that's always great. That's great for me, that's great for them, and that's great for our relationship. So I've really been enjoying it.
It's amazing. I know we mentioned that medicine has long been a male-dominated field, and remnants of that history still shape perceptions that we have today. How have you seen gender-based stereotypes or assumptions about women in authority play out in the clinical settings?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, in clinical settings, women physicians will face, female physicians face this, subtle but persistent stereotypes, right? That just really undermine our authority, So, for example, if I'm leading a team and making decisions, particularly earlier as an attending, as a young attending, I've noticed that my judgment is second guessed more than my male colleagues. And I've had situations where my male nurse practitioner was assumed to be the doctor, and I was assumed to be the NP or the PA simply because of gender expectations. And this is coming after he has walked in and said, "Hi, I'm the neurology NP," and I've walked in and said, "Hi, I'm Dr. Lowe, I'm the neurologist." And then the patients and the families will still say, "Oh, he's the doctor, and I'm either the nurse or the NP or the PA." Despite that's in the face of data that we have given them to suggest otherwise. And so that comes purely from a bias based on gender. And then patients or staff just kind of unconsciously expect the male doctor in the room to be the expert, which just creates these unnecessary barriers, I think. And then there's also just this outdated stereotype that women should be nurturing, but not authoritative. So when female physicians assert themselves, their firmness is viewed negatively. And this, for me, has, and many of my female colleagues, has led to increased reporting of quote unquote behavioral issues against female doctors simply for them being direct or taking charge or setting clear boundaries, while that same behavior would be accepted or even praised in our male colleagues, right? And that is something that I've experienced since a resident and has continued as an attending female physician. And then also there's just kind of like this component of resistance and even subtle bullying from some of the older staff, sometimes older nurses who struggle to accept a young female in a position of authority, which just adds another layer, of that challenge and creating a collaborative environment. And then, as you know, as you go through your attending years and you get a little bit older and you get a little, you know, as they say, a little gray, then, you know, the respect comes. But when you're that fresh attending young and you're female and you're bubbly and you're spunky and you're cute, they're like, you know, they don't take you seriously. So that is definitely a challenge. And on a more personal note, you know, kind of going to being a resident, you know, I was actually bullied by a female attending physician when I was a resident, you know, who I guess felt threatened by me. I don't know what her deal was, but, you know, that experience really highlighted for me the very sad reality that women are not always on each other's sides, particularly in these competitive, high pressured environments like medicine. So instead of solidarity, sometimes, you know, fear or insecurity fuels division, which makes the path even harder for women who are trying to advance. And that's why I've been, you know, so happy to see, you know, the evolution of the girl's girl, right? You know, and everyone's like, oh, I'm a girl's girl. I'm a girl's girl. I'm like, yes, girl, lean into that, be a girl's girl. Cause if we don't support each other, we're in trouble. We don't have the luxury of being divisive and mean to each other, right? We've got enough going against us, all right? We got to help each other out. And then kind of like I touched on this earlier, you know, another stereotype that I think that I have personally encountered is this idea that if you're feminine or if you choose to present yourself as a traditional, quote unquote, pretty, you know, cutesy kind of girl, that somehow you can't be smart or competent, right? You know, this false dichotomy that, you know, you can't be pretty and smart. And it pressures women to downplay aspects of themselves just to be taken seriously, which is unfair and exhausting, right? So, you know, these assumptions and behaviors are just very frustrating. Because they take a toll on you personally, and most importantly, they distract from patient care, you know, and that's what we should really be focusing on, while also placing this additional emotional burden on women who just want to do their jobs effectively.
Absolutely. We had a panel back when I was in my didactic years on the island, and one of our deans of the school, she was like, listen, we're expected to show up and look like the guys and act like the guys, but no, we're not doing that. You wear your heels, you wear your bright pink dress, you do what you want to do. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. This is it. I'm in pink scrubs, red scrubs. I've got the nails, the hair. And here's the thing. You don't have to do that. If that's not who you are and that's just not your style, that's okay. But the point is, whatever your style is irrelevant, because whether you choose to wear makeup or do your hair does not change that degree on your wall. It doesn't change the board certifications. It doesn't change all of your accolades. That's what you're bringing to the table when you walk into the hospital. We're running a stroke code. We're intubating and sedating a patient in status epilepticus. What I have on is irrelevant in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. And men don't have to think about this. They get up, they get dressed. If they're wearing scrubs, if they're wearing professional clothes, it doesn't matter, right? Yeah. But there's, again, this dichotomy that, you know, again, with women, because no matter what we do, it's a problem. If you come to work looking like a hot mess, well, oh, she doesn't take pride in herself and her appearance and, you know, she's whatever. But when you come to work looking fabulous, oh, well, she spends more time. I've actually had someone say she spends more time on makeup than medicine. and it's hilarious, you know, and the people that make these comments, by the way, are, you know, the people who are, you know, projecting their own insecurities. This is not about you, but that's the type of thing that, you know, you hear it and it, although you don't want it to impact your day, it does, you know, and it's easy enough to say, well, I'm just going to ignore it and let it roll off my back. And I do, and keep moving forward. But these are comments that, you know, my husband, who trained at the same place, went to the same med school, works at the same hospital that I do, never once has ever had to even think about, you know, what does that mean, right? And so for me, it's been a very interesting comparison with our journey, because my husband, like I said, we went to the same medical school, we did the same clinicals, we went to the same residency, slightly different because he was internal medicine and I was neurology. And now we work at the same hospital, and our experiences, although we are the same age, same number of years out, have been completely different. And so that's kind of this little social experiment that I have, been able to conduct. And he and I talk about it all the time. And it is, it's very interesting for him to see also. And he is constantly advocating for his female residents and female colleagues because he has seen firsthand, the difference that I have had to go through as compared to him, even though we are basically at the same level.
To kind of follow up on that, I know that even though women have outnumbered men in medical school graduates since 2017, and data shows that physicians off women female women physicians often have better patient outcomes, bias still is there. Why do you think these facts haven't led to more meaningful change in the perception of this culture?
Yeah, so these are positive statistics, but despite that, there's a long-standing cultural bias, and systemic inertia slows progress. Medicine, like many institutions, is shaped by traditions and power structures that are resistant to change. Right? They do not shift quickly, and gender bias is often implicit. It's embedded in how people perceive leadership, communication, competence, and these perceptions don't always change simply because the numbers do, right? So, although women are outnumbering men as graduates of medical school, we're still grossly underrepresented in leadership roles where we could influence that necessary cultural shift. So, again, this is positive. This is reassuring that we see that, women are now outnumbering males as graduates of medical school, and you will see that trickle down effect in the residency classes and the graduates and the attendings. But until organizations actively dismantle, these systemic barriers and challenge this unconscious and sometimes conscious bias, the facts and the numbers alone aren't going to be enough to create meaningful change.
So I know we talked a little bit about this already, but there's often a double standard where assertiveness in male physicians is praised, while similar behavior in women is often labeled as aggressive or difficult. Tell us a little bit more how you've experienced or witnessed this in your career and kind of the consequences you've seen in women trying to lead with this confidence.
Yes. I've definitely experienced this double standard. As I mentioned, I'm from the Bahamas, and so Caribbean culture is what people might perceive as loud and boisterous and very confident. And training in the Midwest, in which it was definitely an adjustment. I wasn't training in New York or Detroit. I was training in West Michigan. Wasn't training in Florida. I was and so. There's definitely a bias here. So, how I've seen it is, my male colleagues are assertive and they are described as confident and decisive, qualities that should be celebrated in medicine, right? But when I or my female colleagues demonstrate these exact same behaviors, we are more likely to be labeled as aggressive or difficult or my favorite, bossy. All right. this really creates a no-win situation for us because women in medicine are expected to be confident and competent, but only within this very narrow, socially acceptable range, right? If you step outside of that and be too assertive, too direct, too unapologetically knowledgeable, you're labeled as arrogant, confrontational, abrasive, or quote unquote, not a team player. But then if you swing too far on the other direction and be soft-spoken or deferential, then people start to question your competence altogether. And I've seen it happen. If a female physician isn't visibly assertive enough, patients and even colleagues will assume she doesn't know what she's doing or that she lacks the competence to make clinical decisions. So what do we do here? It's this impossible paradox. We're expected to project authority because patients want a doctor who exudes confidence. But if that doctor is a woman, there's this unspoken expectation that her confidence has to be carefully contained, confident, but not too confident, decisive, but still likable, in charge, but never intimidating. And it's just like, it's exhausting. And so women in medicine oftentimes find themselves just constantly calibrating their tone, their word choice, their body language, and even their wardrobe, as we said, just to strike this elusive, acceptable balance. And that constant self-monitoring is mentally and emotionally exhausting. And again, it takes focus away from what should be our primary concern, which is patient care, right? And so, over time, this additional emotional labor just chips away at your confidence, and it contributes to that fatigue and that burnout that we're seeing at higher rates in female physicians, and that imposter syndrome that you see at higher rates in female physicians, because so many women experiences it. And then that in turn stifles their leadership potential and is another reason why you have less women in leadership. And then the cycle continues, right? So, we're constantly walking on eggshells to avoid being quote unquote too much. And when you're doing that, when you're constantly trying to walk on those eggshells and just kind of stay in that narrow acceptable range, it's a little hard to take up space and advocate for change and fully step into a leadership role that requires visible, decisive authority. So I just let me be clear, for any women, the women listening to this, the problem here is not women's behavior. The problem is a culture that penalizes us for being fully ourselves in roles that we have earned.
Absolutely. I know that you spoke a little bit on like women having to prove their competence. So I know we talk a little bit about how we have to go that extra mile, sometimes even resorting to what's been called girl flirting or just
Yes.
Yeah. Can you speak a little bit on how these dynamics affect day-to-day interactions with not only like colleagues and staff, but even our patients and their families?
So, again, this just goes back to that additional emotional labor of, and burden of female physicians, right? So in day-to-day interactions, we are often required to go above and beyond to prove our confidence, explaining ourselves more thoroughly, documenting more thoroughly, right? Softening our tone, being overly accommodating just to avoid being labeled as difficult, arrogant, or any of the other adjectives we've used thus far, right? And one coping strategy that has actually been well described is quote unquote girl flirting. And this comes into play not in a romantic sense, but in the way that women are expected to use this charm and friendliness and exaggerated warmth to gain acceptance and reduce resistance, right? So, this is particularly common among female physicians with a predominantly female nursing staff, right? And as a young female physician, there's this unspoken expectation that you need to win over the nurses, right? You got to build rapport, you got to be likable, you got to be extra respectful before you can lead a team without pushback. And that foundation of social capital has to be laid first just to ensure smoother day-to-day workflow, right? Meanwhile, our male colleagues can just walk in, give clear orders, and are met with immediate compliance because their authority is assumed. Ours is questioned until proven, typically repeatedly, right? Right? And so, again, this kind of dynamic is just so draining, and it turns what should be straightforward clinical interactions into this constant dance of emotional management and image control. It's like PR, right? And then it also takes up time that could be spent, yet again, on patient care or academic growth, reading, or just taking some time for you, right? And it just reinforces this idea that women in medicine have to work harder, not just intellectually, but also socially, just to be respected. And in the long run, this contributes again to the burnout, and it makes the workplace feel like, a place of less like a place of professional collaboration and more like a stage where you just have to keep performing in the right way to maintain credibility. And again, it's exhausting.
So before we wrap up, what advice would you give to women entering medicine today who may already be feeling this, the weight of these challenges? What has helped you kind of stay grounded and resilient in your own journey?
Yes. So my advice is, embrace your competence and confidence unapologetically. All right. These are your strengths. They are not flaws. You do not have to shrink yourself to make others comfortable. And the more you show up as your full, capable self, the more space you create for others to do the same thing. Right. So, be sure to surround yourself with mentors and peers who truly support and uplift you, and seek out communities like the American Medical Women's Association, where you can find solidarity and advocacy, right? And then it's also important, key really, to prioritize your self-care and recognize that feeling burnout or imposter syndrome is in no way a personal failure. It's a reflection of issues within a system that was not built with us in mind. And I have found that that recognition in particular is very freeing because it shifts the blame off of you and it puts it where it belongs, which is onto a system that needs to change. And again, for me, creating Dr. Brain Barbie really was a turning point. It allowed me to channel a lot of my frustrations into something purposeful. Not to say everybody needs to create a social media because it's also time consuming, but you find ways to kind of channel these frustrations, right? And for me, this has allowed me to educate patients, advocate for equity, redefine what women in medicine and women in neurology can look like, right? I wanted to show that you can be brilliant and bold and feminine and fierce and still be taken seriously. And, for me, it's a platform where I can connect with others on my own terms and model a version of medicine that's inclusive and compassionate and authentic. To any woman entering this field, just know that your voice and your presence and your perspective are valid and are absolutely vital to changing the culture of medicine because we are the future of this profession, and it's time that the system evolved to reflect that.
Thank you so much for your wise words today, Dr. Lowe, and for being here with us. So that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you of the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and if you love this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.